Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the London School of Economics and to this inaugural lecture by Professor Mia Rodriguez Salgado. For me, it's an enormous pleasure and a privilege to be able to introduce Mia tonight. I fear I, in a sense, have the dirty end of the stick, since I have to give you a rather boring list of facts, because basically what you want to do is hear Mia and not me. So I'll race through her biography as quickly as possible, since this is the normal procedure on such occasions. Mia was educated at the University of Durham and did her PhD at the University of Hull, has a long experience in several British universities, was first of all a lecturer at St Andrews, then a research fellow and a lecturer at the University of Newcastle, coming here to the London School of Economics in 1985, where she was successively lecturer, then reader in, made reader in 1993, and finally, much belatedly and very deservedly, made professor in 1995. The simple recital of Mia's publications can barely, I think, indicate the importance of her work, which taken as a whole is a sweeping and ambitious reconsideration of major great power politics in the 16th century. Most of you will be familiar with her three major books, The Changing Face of Empire, Charles V, Philip II, and Habsburg Authority, published by Cambridge University Press in 1988 and then translated into both Spanish and Italian. The remarkable catalogue that she directed for the Great Exhibition at the National Maritime Museum, the Great Exhibition on the Armada, which was published also in 1988, and her book with Simon Adams, England, Spain, and the Gran Armada. Now, some indication of the remarkable impact of her work, I think, can be deduced from the honours that she's received in Spain. Now, you might think, given that Mia Rodriguez Salgado certainly sounds like a Spanish name, that this is the sort of thing that happens to Spaniards all the time. But I also say, before listing these honours, that as anyone who knows anything about the Spanish intellectual life and Spanish academia in particular, that the Spaniards are extremely unforgiving of those who ply their trade elsewhere. So the fact that Mia, in 1989, for her services to Spanish culture, was made a Dame of the Order of Isabel la Católica, and in 1989 was given the Spanish Naval Cross First Class for her work on maritime history, were both fairly remarkable honours. And of course, as anyone has ever seen her walk down a street in Spain and see Spanish sailors saluting her, we'll realise this is not just a question of her imposing presence, but also a symbol of her very great importance. The other day, I was in Spain last week and was astonished to see a 40-foot-high poster in the book fair in Madrid advertising one of her articles. Perhaps the biggest honour of all, and a very, very important honour, came in only last year when she was made a corresponding fellow of the Royal Academy of History in Spain. Now, neither the list of publications nor these honours reveal the extent to which Mia Rodriguez Salgado is the kind of scholar who's never put the building of a curriculum vitae before her own exacting standards. Her research has always been driven by a determination to produce something truly original. And to read the works of Mia Rodriguez, for my next trick I'll pronounce this correctly. To read the works of Mia Rodriguez Salgado is to be in the presence of a powerful, forensic, and deeply creative intelligence. It goes without saying that her contribution to the academic world in general, and to the London School of Economics in particular, has not just consisted of her research. Indeed, her research output has been matched by the tremendous contribution that she's made to teaching within the Department of International History over a wide range of topics in European and international history, to the administration of the school, and of course to bringing both the Department of International History and indeed the London School of Economics as a whole screaming into the 20th century in terms of information technology and the use of multimedia techniques in teaching. And I think it's recognised nationally that it's in the use of these things for historians that she's been a notable pioneer. The continuing quest of Mir's research into the politics, economics, and military strategy of far-flung empire has produced a stream indeed, of seminal articles, which have in their turn created the greatest of expectation both in this country and in Spain and in Italy, certainly, and probably elsewhere in Europe, with regard to her forthcoming books, The Greatest Prince in Christendom, Philip II and His World in the 1560s, and on the cultural dimensions of the conflictive relations between England and Spain in the 16th century. Her work is a remarkable fusion of political, economic, diplomatic, and religious history, a glimpse of which will be a rare treat for us tonight when she talks to us about Cupid, Mars, and Armageddon. Mir.
Thank you very much. I can only say that Paul Preston, as a friend, felt in need of giving me such a tremendous introduction. I'm very grateful to him, and also to have this opportunity to say in public how much we in the history department, and myself in particular, have appreciated all the efforts that he's made since he came here. He was the best thing that happened to history at LSE for a long time, so thank you, Paul. Now I'm going to try and use this new system, and I hope if I can actually do it properly, it might work. 400 years ago, Philip II was in Madrid preparing what he reckoned to be his final journey to the monastery palace of the Escorial. He had just celebrated his 71st birthday, a very advanced age for the time. Conscious that he was dying, he was anxious to put an end to the wars that had drained and devastated his empire. He signed peace with France on the 2nd of May of 1598, but he failed to come to terms with the rebel provinces of the northern Netherlands or with their ally, Elizabeth Tudor. He died after a long and agonizing illness on the 27th of September, still at war with the North. I thought it particularly apt to give my inaugural lecture before this, the 400th anniversary of Philip II's death, had passed, and to use the occasion to reflect on the first historical topic that I ever researched, the trajectory of Philip II's relations with England from friendship to hostility. So it's a particular pleasure to me to see two of my early mentors, David Lodes and Helle Königsberger, here to see how far I've got. I shall have to ask them subsequently. Anglo-Spanish relations in the second half of the 16th century have been presented as a paradigm of a confessional conflict that tore Europe apart. Spain's foremost historian of the subject, Manuel Fernández Álvarez, put it starkly. Philip II and Elizabeth of England, an impossible peace. That was the title he used in an unpublished paper for a conference on the Armada. He concluded, and I quote, "The peace was effectively broken when religious fanaticism intensified on both sides. It was this that made peace impossible." He clearly appreciated, however, that the conflict was not simply ideological and followed his dramatic statement by alluding to two other causes of the war. First, Spain's determination to preserve the Netherlands, which he condemns as a form of quixotic imperialism. Second, economic competition, which for him means essentially control of American trade. His vision of the Anglo-Spanish War is that of a titanic struggle over faith, political status, and economic primacy. Other historians vary as to the weight that they give to these three elements, but they agree about the causes and they echo his sentiments both as to the magnitude of the struggle and its inevitability. Although, and almost without exception, historians have commented on the strenuous efforts made by both sides to avoid war. In a recent and very influential work on the Armada of 1588, Geoffrey Parker and Colin Martin tentatively dated the origins of the war to the 1530s, when Henry VIII married Anne Boleyn, left the Catholic Church, and embraced Protestantism. After Elizabeth came to power in 1559, they see it as a countdown to war. I quote, "The king recognized then that such action was both desirable and ultimately inevitable, but always he put off the fateful confrontation." Well, not quite always, of course. They argue that in 1585, Drake's attack against northwest Spain, I quote again, convinced Philip II that the time had come to carry out his threat of 1559, to make war on Elizabeth. Now, consensus among historians is a rare thing, particularly when it crosses national boundaries. So this is very intriguing and unusual state of affairs. It's even more surprising when, as in this case, it entails what seems to me is somewhat tortuous line of argument. We're asked to accept the inevitability of a conflict that both sides wanted to avoid, which had its roots in the 1530s, if not earlier, became inescapable after 1559, but didn't break out until the late 1580s. And most writers leave it there, building up to a dramatic narrative of the Armada of 1588. A few hardy souls have taken the story a little bit further to the disastrous English campaign of 1589, about which I'm sure most of you have never heard of. Most texts studiously ignore the aftermath, which is unsurprising, since the so-called war was then reduced to a few small-scale and largely unsuccessful actions and irregular activity from pirates, hardly the stuff of legend, although some of the incidents have received quite heroic treatment. But it's a pretty paltry showing for a struggle where so much was ostensibly at stake. Now, more serious problems arise if we go a little further still to the negotiations of peace, and if I can get them in focus. The negotiations of peace that took place in 1603. And this is a depiction, which I don't know how well you can see, of the talks at Hampton Court, showing you the Spanish plenipotentiaries on the left and the English headed by Cecil on the right. Now, we might expect these to have a tense and dramatic end, but the reality is somewhat different. There was heated debate, but most of it was about the necessity of formal negotiations at all, because, as the Venetian ambassador in London, Giovanni Carlo Scaramelli, reminded the Doge, I quote, "As a matter of fact, war has never been actually declared by either party." Now, Scaramelli went on to paint a confusing picture of the discussions, which is nevertheless, I think, most illuminating, so I'm going to quote it in all its confusion. It is said that, well, whenever it suited them to say so, the Spanish have always maintained that the war was a private quarrel between Philip II and Queen Elizabeth, which began, as the English now say, in some lovers' disagreement, and was fed by reasons of state and gradually passed into hatred and finally into open hostility. Not a titanic clash of irreconcilable ideologies and political and economic systems then, but a lover's tiff that got out of hand. Well, with such diverse perceptions, how are we to understand the conflict? I hope to persuade you in the course of this lecture that we need to shed the existing historical consensus and to begin from quite the opposite perspective. Peace between Philip II and Elizabeth was far from impossible. In fact, it was natural. Until, that is, the international situation changed dramatically, allowing a realignment of European powers, religious ideology played a part in these changes, but its influence was far from straightforward or consistent. It certainly did not make war between Catholics and Protestants inevitable. Philip's story in England, if I can get him focused, started under the sign of Venus. So I thought it apt to show you a portrait that he commissioned from Titian showing Venus and Adonis, which comes roughly from the period when he was King of England. Although I think it has to be said that his marriage to Mary Tudor, and we see it here in a portrait done subsequently, was hardly a result of the accurate aim of Cupid's arrows, but due to political and military needs. Again, this is a suitable vision because it actually shows Philip with Mars behind him. So my two gods have appeared quite early on in this talk. Now, the reason for the match were similar to those that had prompted earlier Anglo-Spanish marriages, most notably that of Mary Tudor's own parents, Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. England and Spain had been inexorably drawn together over the centuries by fear of a common enemy, France. This had also prompted repeated alliances between them with another of France's close enemies and rivals, the Burgundian Netherlands. Political needs were reinforced by close commercial bonds between the three states. As was habitual at the time, alliances were sealed with royal marriages. And this dynastic system led to some spectacular state formations, none more so than the empire which Charles V inherited in the early 16th century, which stretched from North Africa to the Americas, and which I want to focus here in Europe, contained the two main areas of Iberia, Castile and Aragon, the southern Italian states, as well as Milan, which he got subsequently. And then the Burgundian Netherlands, which was a scattered state, including the Franche-Comté here, which was part of Burgundy, and an area which is roughly covered by modern-day Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg up in the north. It was quite an extraordinary empire put together from four different inheritances. Now, by the late 15th century, however, it was France which had emerged as the most compact, wealthy, and powerful state of early modern Europe. It was widely feared that it would impose monarchia, that means universal monarchy, a 16th century term that corresponds roughly to current notions of hegemony, when one state acquires such overwhelming power that it can contain and even control others. It was assumed at the time that great powers would naturally seek enlargement and would make a bid for hegemony. They also believed that interstate relationships were determined by emulation. Each power would seek to equal and, if possible, overtake its rivals. Emulation, like the search for supremacy, was considered a natural pattern of behavior. So an inevitable war at this juncture was a war for hegemony between two roughly equal states or alliance systems. As the imperial advisor Granvelle put it in 1550, Charles V was necessarily obliged to enter into war with France, because whoever fears war incites his adversaries to begin it. The most Christian king, that was the King of France, will not stand by with his arms folded while his majesty continues to claim hegemony. When Philip II married Mary Tudor, Charles V was still fighting France and losing. English resources were needed to reverse the unfavorable balance, and they helped Philip II, who took over the tottering empire in 1556, to halt the French advance. He remained convinced for many years that English friendship was vital for the preservation of the now isolated Netherlands and to keep open essential military and trade routes from Spain. And you can see by looking at the map just how important the friendship of England was if they wanted to keep that vital route open. Now, Elizabeth's accession, they did promise me that this was a wonderful system, but I don't know how well you can see these slides at all. Elizabeth's accession in November 1558 provoked a brief but significant crisis. She was known to favor the Protestants and was likely to reverse the restoration of Catholicism in England, which Philip had helped to bring about. Now, this caused him considerable anguish. Unfortunately for him, the claimant, Catholic claimant to the throne, was none other than Mary Stuart, Queen of Scotland and soon to be Queen of France. And you see her here in a later portrait as a Catholic icon. She has so many crosses, you can almost not quite sort of see the rest of her and rosaries and so on. If Mary Stuart and her husband, the later King of France, took over England, it's quite obvious what this would mean. A huge, enormously powerful French empire would be created, stretching from the Mediterranean across the Channel to the North Sea. Philip II and his advisers were quite convinced that this would result in an immediate attack against the Netherlands, which was an area that the French had been trying to get for a very long time, and that this would be followed by a successful French bid for hegemony. Even after Mary Stuart lost the French throne, Philip II continued to see her as a French candidate and thus potentially dangerous. He was always very ambivalent about her. Now, as a legitimate sovereign, Philip II had a God-given duty to protect and maintain the Netherlands. It was not a matter of imperialism, as Fernando de Alvarez says, it was his God-given duty. However, as a Catholic monarch, he had a God-given duty to protect and advance the faith in England. In 1559, there was only one way to achieve both these ends. if he married Elizabeth Tudor. His chief counselors urged him to do this, and they warned him that if he did not marry her, then he must preempt a French invasion on behalf of Mary Stuart and launch his own invasion of England. Philip II thought both options equally repellent. He confided in the Count of Feria that he did not find Elizabeth attractive, that he had no desire to marry her at all, but after much pressure, he was persuaded to propose. In January 1559, he initiated marriage negotiations, confessing in a letter that's absolutely filled with anguish that he felt like a man condemned. And this theme of self-sacrifice for the sake of Catholicism in England filled the king's letters. A quote from one of them, "I have offered myself up to God and believe that he will put before me whatever is best for his service." Well, God clearly heard his prayers, because almost immediately the French parried this move by insisting that he should take the young and Catholic French princess, Elizabeth de Valois, shown here a little bit later, dutifully holding a little cameo of her husband in her hand. No great beauty either, but Philip II accepted this marriage with alacrity. It was a way out of what had clearly been an acute personal and political turmoil over the English match. Now, significantly, neither the peace nor the marriage lessened the rivalry between the French and the Spanish kings over England. When the Pope urged them to take action, Philip firmly instructed him on the intricacies of the situation. If the French invaded, Philip could not tolerate this aggrandizement and would have to fight, even, as one of his advisers put it, if that meant that he would ally with the wrong side being the Protestants. Now, if Philip II invaded, the French, of course, would have no option but to attack him in order to defend Mary Stuart's dynastic rights, as well as to counter his bid for hegemony. Partition, which was another option, was out of the question, because an earlier experiment between France and Spain to partition Naples in 1500 had failed disastrously and provoked a new war. By the summer of 1559, therefore, it was clear that the traditional emulation between these two powers protected Elizabeth and England as nothing else could have done. She was to exploit this for the rest of her life. And having rejected both marriage and invasion, Philip II and Elizabeth settled the terms of alliance and form of words that had been sworn in 1543 by Charles V and Henry VIII. They decided to use the same terms, brotherhood and perpetual alliance. And in 1559, as in 1543, this united two princes who had espoused irreconcilable Christian creeds. The ideological gulf did not prevent them from making frequent references over the following two decades to, I quote, the peace and friendship, as well as the present love and ancient amity that bound them. But tension between Catholics and Protestants was growing. Calvinism and the revitalized Catholic Church organized the opposing creeds into much more aggressive missionary groups that were determined to impose their particular vision of godly society and preach the extermination of the enemies of the Lord. And you have a scene there from the war in the Netherlands, where rebels, Protestant rebels, were being both decapitated and hanged, and a scene of the burning of heretics with the symbolic burning of Christ in the corner as well, which can serve as my icons for this particular section. Now, because the peace between Spain and France had broken the pattern of state alliances that had dominated European politics for half a century, there was some expectation after 1559 that the Christian powers would realign along ideological lines. Many Protestants feared that Spain and France might now ally against them, and there were moves almost immediately to create a Protestant League. For some, the terrifying visions of St. John seemed very close to fulfillment. In the Apocalypse, St. John recounts how God was so incensed by the outbreak of heresy and the murder of some of his prophets and followers that he decided to punish the earth by sending angels with epidemics and natural disasters, until, goaded by this, the devil retaliated by summoning, and I quote from the Apocalypse, all the kings of the world, bidding them meet in battle when the great day comes, the day of Almighty God, the place where they are bidden to meet is the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. The final battle between the forces of good and evil, very frequently portrayed as in this Bruegel portrait as the battle between the good and the bad angel, was certainly believed to be inevitable, but what there was no clear indication of when the call would come. Crucially, during this period, most rulers believed that the opposing creeds were roughly equal in power, and both sides had infiltrated every state, so each had a potentially lethal fifth column to contend with. Now, this perception of acute danger contributed to the widespread conviction that if Europe divided into two religious camps, it would trigger an eternal war that could only end with the destruction of the world. As one French Catholic put it, while all other wars could be terminated, that for religion had no end. And for some, this meant that it was imperative to avert this catastrophe. So in the 16th century, as in the 20th, belief in Armageddon both intensified fear and acted as an effective deterrent. The desire to deflect the formation of enemy coalitions was general, but Philip II was particularly anxious to avoid giving the impression of a Catholic League so as not to trigger a Protestant one. And his role is really fundamental in averting the polarization of international politics in this period. And as happened more recently, the result of these pressures and fears was that while major wars were averted, conflict surfaced in a series of long and bloody localized wars which were fanned by foreign intervention, intervention that destabilized Western Europe for decades. Whereas hitherto the accepted morality governing interstate relations dictated that no ruler should help rebels, religious ideology now provided a powerful incentive to intervene and a moral justification for doing so. When the marriage negotiations between Elizabeth and Philip ended, the Duke of Alba advised the king, and I quote, to make sure to favor and sustain the Catholics of that kingdom, and thus, while being of service to God, your majesty will have such influence over the realm that whenever you judge it appropriate and are less occupied than you are at present, you can change the government. Philip II's response was partial and lukewarm and stands in stark contrast to his intervention in neighboring France. The spread of Protestantism in France was considered by the Spaniards as tantamount to an internal problem. They believed that if the Protestants won in that kingdom, it would signal the end of Catholicism in general and would trigger an immediate war over the Netherlands. Consequently, Philip II gave priority to events in France for the rest of his life. Protestants elsewhere were less of a threat. The German princes and even Elizabeth at one stage were informed blandly that Philip II had no intention of attacking them, for he had no more responsibility for their souls than they had for his. But his sense of responsibility for English Catholics haunted him and periodically prompted fitful intervention in England. He might have done more if he had been convinced that Catholicism could count on substantial support from the English elites. But like most of his contemporaries, Philip believed that the English wore their religion lightly. They'd changed so often. And as one wag commented, the English would turn Muslim overnight if the monarch converted to Islam. The king's annotations in various letters leave us in no doubt as to his conviction that most of the English elite were either lukewarm time servers or rank heretics. Only a few merited the term good Catholic. Even in 1588, when he was planning an invasion, he put as much faith in getting support in England through his dynastic claims than through his religious persuasion. The earliest and most skilled player of the interventionist game in this period was Elizabeth. She began her reign by meddling in the civil war in Scotland and continued with a similar mix of covert and open operations in France and in the Netherlands from the 1560s to her death, covering her steps with a veritable cloak of hypocrisy and double dealing that marked her as a consummate actress and politician from the start. And I think something of the complexity of the situation can be seen in a cartoon or painting that was done in the Netherlands. Now, because it's a Netherlander who did it, it's all right for me to point out without any embarrassment that the Netherlands is the cow that you see there. And riding the cow, in other words, trying to control and to do something that is unnatural, is the king, Philip II. Clearly not very intelligent way of dealing with his subjects there. Milking the cow, exploiting it, is the Duke of Alba. But perhaps the more interesting figures are the ones on the left. You see Elizabeth, already kind of virginal in her white, feeding the cow with a little bit of hay. And next to her, looking in great sort of admiration, is the leader of the rebels, William of Orange. Now, I don't know if I focus it quite clearly enough, probably not, but perhaps you can see what the cow is doing to the other person who is intervening here, the French, the heir to the French throne, the Duke of Anjou. The cow is shitting on him. And there were lots of different versions of this particular painting. I'll just show you another one, which shows the this time you can tell that it was a Catholic rebel that did it, because milking the cow is the Protestant rebel leader, William of Orange. Now you can see Philip in a much more sort of active attempt to ride the cow and move it on. Again, we've got the Duke of Anjou, this time it's his brother, holding the tail and nasty things happening to him. Elizabeth now giving a lot more help with a very generous bale of hay and water, and looking at her admiringly, a group that represents the rebel provinces. Now, this is interesting not only for highlighting that both the French and the English were meddling regularly in the Netherlands, but it's worth saying that the English queen was an Anglican, that William of Orange, doing the milking there, had started off as a Catholic, became a Lutheran, and then a Calvinist. At the other end, the Duke of Anjou was a Catholic, and yet he was negotiating marriage with Elizabeth, and acted, and she supported him. And that group of rebel provinces included Catholics, Anabaptists, Lutherans, as well as Calvinists. It's a real mix. And what's interesting about this also is who isn't there. Look at poor Philip. He's all alone. Nobody's helping him. Where is the Pope? Where is the leader of the Catholic princes, the Holy Roman Emperor, who was initially his uncle, then his cousin, then his nephew? They're not there to help him. And the reason that they're not there to help him is that despite the increasing religious tensions, fears of universal monarchy remained and often dictated foreign policy at this time. The Catholic princes did not want Philip to grow any more powerful, and actually found it very convenient that he was being weakened and held down in the Netherlands with a long war. Now, in the case of Elizabethan England, it could be said that the two elements combined in the person of Philip II. The Royal Council repeatedly urged and justified an aggressive policy on the grounds that Philip II was leader of the Catholic camp and a potential hegemon. Secretary Cecil complained at one stage, "The Spanish nation is strange and wishes to be lord of all the world." The establishment of a strong Spanish military presence in the Netherlands in 1567 created a permanent state of anxiety in England, and many Spaniards accepted from this point onwards that for as long as there were Spanish troops in the Netherlands, Elizabeth would seek to undermine them. Some years later, as war raged, the Netherlander Justus Lipsius commented that fear rather than hatred was behind the growing hostility between the two kingdoms. In his view, Elizabeth was not opposed to peace. After all, she was a woman. And she was not only a woman, but a woman with very limited resources, ruling over a people who preferred commerce and freedom to war. It was, he said, and I quote, "the greatness of our king, the valor and good fortune of the Spaniards that have made them terrifying over these last 60 years, both to our neighbors and to more distant states." Lipsius thus discounted both personal motives and ideological ones. This conflict was a question of power politics. An even sharper analysis of Elizabeth's position came from the pen of Bernardino de Escalante, who became a key advisor on English affairs to Philip II from 1586 onwards. Escalante lucidly explained that the checks and balances that had existed to contain England in the past had been effectively removed by 1559. Scotland had contained England for generations, frequently in conjunction with France. But after 1560, a friendly and sometimes subservient Protestant regime had been established there and transformed a longtime enemy into a friend. The Civil War had weakened France, and there was a Protestant faction that had become a powerful, if not always reliable, ally of England. And a similar situation prevailed in the Netherlands with the war there, preventing them from responding to England's commercial as well as political aggression. Finally, the continuing emulation between France and Spain guaranteed that neither power would allow the other to act against Elizabeth. The only weak point that he could see in Elizabeth's armor was Ireland. But Ireland was too deeply divided by faith, culture, and tradition to be easily exploited. Moreover, it was desperately poor, and it was occupied by clans that were considered by contemporaries to be savages and quite useless when it came to regular war, however nasty they were. Escalante was emphatic that the balance of power had shifted decisively in favor of England, which now had no external enemies. Consequently, Elizabeth was behaving as one would expect a rational ruler to behave under the circumstances, that is, to take advantage, to weaken her powerful neighbors, and to extend her empire. The ideological differences between England and Spain were almost incidental to this conflict. Escalante believed that fear of Philip's potential for universal monarchy had been Elizabeth's best defense and a tool that she had very skillfully exploited. These contemporary evaluations of Elizabethan policy are of the greatest interest because the current historiography has almost invariably presented it as defensive, as reactive, as full of fear of Catholic leagues and conspiracies. Now, many English counselors certainly saw the world in these terms, and they felt themselves to be part of a struggle between good and evil. The flower of English poets, Sir Philip Sidney, who, ironically enough, of course, had been named after his godfather, Philip II, died fighting his godfather in the Netherlands. Shortly before his death, he whipped up his troops by reminding them, and I quote, "against whom they fought, men of false religion, enemies to God and his church, against Antichrist, Philip, and against a people, the Spaniards, whose unkindness both in nature and in life did so excel that God would not leave them unpunished." Apocalyptic fears certainly existed and periodically flared up to a full-scale panic, but it is really important to appreciate that much of this kind of talk was posturing. Ideological rhetoric was essential since English intervention could not be justified by any other means. The documentation also tells us in less striking but highly significant detail that the English counselors were acutely conscious of Philip II's weakness and preoccupations. At each major crisis with Spain, in England, opportunism and fear are both equally evident. And I don't think that anybody who looks at some of the portraits of Elizabeth at this point, and this, the so-called Armada portrait, can really doubt that there was a sense of great sort of a sense of their own power, a sense of their own position. Now, it's equally important to appreciate that Philip II and his council did not see the world purely in terms of ideological confrontations either. Had he not shared the awareness of such commentators about the geostrategic and conjunctural roots of the conflict, it would have been harder for him to tolerate the constant harassment he endured until the 1580s. The use of evocative quotations across the period has really created a false impression of ever-escalating conflict. But in fact, the pattern of their relations was otherwise. The peace was punctuated with occasional sharp crises, of which one of the most serious was that between 1568 and 1571. Elizabeth, at this point, was supporting piracy in the Channel and in the Atlantic. She was supporting the rebels in the Netherlands, and she also seized money which was destined for Philip's troops in the Netherlands. All of this could be construed as a casus belli. And yet, the situation was contained when both sides opted to present these hostilities in terms of a commercial dispute that had got out of hand. And because it was a commercial dispute, it primarily affected merchants and bankers rather than rulers. At the time, Philip II could not respond because he faced not only the rebellions in the Netherlands, but a Hispano-Muslim rebellion in Spain, and he was at war with the Muslim powers in the Mediterranean. Similar tactics got him out a decade later from a similar situation. Drake's circumnavigation of the globe was accompanied by quite considerable depredations against the Spanish Empire. But at the time, Philip II was busy with the conquest of Portugal and not willing to respond militarily to this. So again, he left it up to the mercantile community to negotiate for compensation and pulled back from the fray. Now, what this demonstrates is that diplomatic conventions of the time were highly flexible, and they helped to maintain the peace despite these tensions. Dissimulation, in fact, was a crucial tool in managing tension. Elizabeth was wise enough to leave escape routes open. She frequently refused to give official licenses for attacks, despite lending royal ships and part financing some of these expeditions. Another habitual trick of hers was to issue them with contrary orders. One minute she'd say, sail and attack, the next minute she'd say, no, don't, stay put. This would allow her to repudiate the individuals and repudiate their actions. Even when she did make an open commitment by signing a formal agreement with the Dutch rebels in 1585, she immediately threw up a smokescreen by requesting peace talks and making much of her refusal to accept the sovereignty over the area that they offered her. Other more subtle forms of dissimulation besides disingenuous arguments were practiced, particularly the adoption of other personae. Now, ambassadors regularly raised matters and proposals as if it were entirely their own idea and their own initiative, rather than on commission, that is, with a direct order, direct instructions from the monarch. This meant that they could express opinions much more openly and indeed bluntly without giving offense, and they could exchange information without losing honor. Let me give you one example from 1559, when the English were most anxious to know from Spain what Philip II's attitude was towards Elizabeth's intervention in Scotland on behalf of Protestant rebels. The English ambassador, Challoner, approached Granvelle, who was then Bishop of Arras and one of Philip II's leading counselors. It's very delicate. So he says, about Scotland. Monsieur l'ambassadeur, says Granvelle, to this your demand, ye must give me leave to demand of you whether ye ask me this as ambassador by commission or else as of yourself, and whether ye ask me as a counselor or else as the Bishop of Arras privately. And Challoner responded, no, it's not by commission, complete lie, of course it was, nor yet as ambassador, but as one in particular by way of a private conference. So at that point, they got down to business, and Granvelle told him in no uncertain terms that Elizabeth was a fool to get involved in Scotland, nothing to do with religion, but the fear was that she would trigger off a war with France. During another very tense period in the summer of 1581, the Queen made use of this device too. She had repeatedly refused to see the Spanish ambassador, and one further denial would really leave him no option but to leave the court. Now, she didn't want this because it could trigger off a really serious incident, but she didn't want to see him either. So, I quote from Don Bernardino de Mendoza's letter. She asked me as a queen, woman and lady, if I should hold back, declaring that monarchs seldom made such strong entreaties of ministers as that which she was asking of Don Bernardino de Mendoza, in other words, not of him as an ambassador. And she would be most shocked if I, being a Spaniard and a Mendoza, and having frequently reassured her of the desire I had to serve her, should reject this petition that she was making of me as a lady. I sent this message to her, that I would not dare show my face in the presence of Spanish ladies if I had refused such a request and petition from her, who besides being queen was so great a lady. Subsequently, however, the situation became so tense that both sides diffused tension by getting rid of ambassadors altogether and continuing relations with just very occasional low-level embassies. Now, it's essential to appreciate that with the exception of a brief period during the later 1580s, English activities were never considered so dangerous to Philip II's empire, status, or faith as to merit the diversion of his scarce resources. Isolated attacks against shipping, the burning of settlements, well, much worse than this was happening in the Mediterranean. Elizabeth simply was making sort of pinpricks on his power, nothing very substantial. Philip II had much more important concerns to deal with, notably the rebellions in the Netherlands and Spain, war in the Mediterranean, and expansion too, expansion into Portugal and in the New World. These were his priorities. But by 1583, he was becoming so weary at the constant provocation that for the first time in his life, he endorsed a plot for Elizabeth's assassination. Political assassination, in fact, became all the rage in the 1580s, partly because it offered a quick and cheap solution to intractable problems, but also due to the encouragement of the papacy. In 1580, English exiles at the Spanish court sought a formal ruling from the Pope and asked, would they be committing a sin if they attempted to murder Elizabeth? They were told by the nuncio reporting the Pope's words, not only would they not sin, but on the contrary, it would be a meritorious act. Now, this brings me to the matter of papal influence over Philip II's policy. Although every pope after 1559 demanded action against England, their influence was always limited by their refusal to provide concrete aid for such an enterprise. In 1571, the Duke of Alba noted, I quote, "Papal policy can truly be said to be more divine than earthly, because the Pope places all his trust in God." Oh, of course, Alba hastily added, all good Christians should do this, but having so much of the world in us, His Holiness should not marvel at the fact that we also want to use human resources to conquer England, and wouldn't it be jolly nice if he provided them with money and troops. Trusting God clearly did not extend to launching madcap campaigns. Before his death, Philip II warned his son never to endanger his life and lands in crusades that could not be carried out safely. A king without resources was no use to God or the church. Whether he read it or not, he certainly was in full agreement with the advice that Charles V's confessor gave him in 1530, when Charles was terribly keen to launch a major attack against the Protestants. Your Majesty is not bound by duty to lose, but to spend all your forces, your life and states even, in a war of this sort only when by reasonable evidence there is some hope of victory. Only once, in 1579, did Philip II tailor his English policy to that of the Pope. Gregory XIII had responded to news of his truce with the Turks. Philip had initially made a truce and then was negotiating for peace with the Ottoman Sultan. And the Pope responded by withdrawing Philip's right to levy taxes from the enormously wealthy Spanish church. This is just after Philip II had declared bankruptcy. So it's a very tense situation. To recover his Catholic credentials and hopefully his subsidies, Philip II then agreed to support the papal expedition to Ireland, which ended in the massacre of the Catholics at Smerwick. The incident has been used to prove the growing hostility Philip to Elizabeth. In fact, it had really nothing to do with her. It was about getting some money out of the Catholic Church. Why then, if Philip had resisted for so long and found so many good reasons not to respond to Elizabeth's hostility, why does he finally decide to act against England? Well, there were three occasions when he seriously considered the a possibility. 1559, 1571, both of which I've touched on, and 1585. But it was during the 71 crisis that Philip II and his counselors worked out in great detail the conditions that would be required before he could seriously consider responding to English hostility with military force. First, they decided there had to be good cause, a just cause. Now, this was not going to be difficult, of course, because Elizabeth was provoking him all the time. But apart from provocation, having a just and good cause really meant that it had to be more important than all the other good causes that he had to deal with elsewhere. The second point was that the situation had to be propitious. Now, what this meant was neutralizing Elizabeth's potential and existing allies, as well as neutralizing Philip's enemies, although these two overlapped substantially. And finally, he would need to have a sufficient military and financial resources. Now, such a conjuncture existed only briefly between 1585 and 1588. The provocation is well known. Elizabeth escalated hostilities with more attacks against the New World and Spain, attempting to take over a part of the Americas and establish English colonies there. By her alliance with the Dutch rebels, which led to English troops crossing the Channel and taking possession of several major towns in the Netherlands, and also by trying to weld together a wide-ranging coalition that included the Ottoman and Moroccan sultans, the Catholic rebels of Portugal, the Protestant rebels of the Netherlands, as well as the French and German Protestants. A rather unholy but absolutely terrifying spectre for Philip II. And all this, Secretary Walsingham was pleased to call a plot to annoy the King of Spain. Walsingham was convinced that a preemptive strike was necessary because he really believed Philip II would soon turn the forces of the Catholic world against England, or so he said. Philip certainly had no such plans, but he did interpret these multiple moves of Elizabeth as a declaration of war. Now, he didn't wait for a formal declaration because he was convinced that Elizabeth could not possibly issue one because she did not have a just cause to attack him. He'd done nothing against her. Now, it was not only that he was now so angry or that he thought that the threat was much worse, although both these elements are there. He would still not have moved if the international situation had not been propitious. But it was, because temporarily, France was neutralized as a result of the intensification of the struggle between the Catholic League and the King and the Protestants. However, as in 1571, Philip II was not convinced that this international conjuncture would remain favorable for long, so he did not want to commit himself completely to the English war. A quote from one of his letters, he decided for retaliation, but without committing myself further for now. I don't want to get involved in the situation. That if in the course of this campaign other matters should arise that force us to change our mind, we must be free to do so. Now, one might have thought that even without Philip's declaration of war, though it was very clear what the motives for the campaign were. But circumstances dictated that he must present it in different ways for different publics. And above all, it was important for him to present it as a crusade in order to secure help from the Pope and from the Catholic princes. They, in turn, sought to avoid having to send him aid because they believed that his success in England would give him hegemony. So what do? They questioned his ideological commitment. They claimed that he was launching a war not for the faith, but merely to recover his dented reputation and to defend his realm. So this muddied the waters, and this left the issue of the true causation of the war unclear, even for contemporaries. And this is really rather a pity in one sense, because there's no doubt that during the long period of gestation for the campaign, Spain was overwhelmed by what can be called an orgy of liturgical activity, with countless processions, prayer meetings, and services, which turned the war against England for Philip, for his court, for most of his subjects, into not only a crusade, but something akin to an ordeal. That means an appeal to God to show justice on earth. But the campaign was, unfortunately, an expensive fiasco. It is only in legend and subsequently that the Armada has been portrayed as a great titanic conflict where heroes fought eye to eye, more or less, as it shows in this painting. As was noted long ago, the Armada actually left surprisingly little mark on English literature, or indeed in English paintings. The best known texts and images that we have of it were produced after the event, frequently long after the event, and almost entirely by Netherlanders, not English. And like this, which is a Netherlands portrait, most of the images were entirely false. You can't ask a painter to show a dramatic scene without getting this sort of result. But in fact, most of the time that the Spanish fleet was in the channel, they were far too far from the English fleet to do very much. There were a few cannonballs that plopped conveniently in the water in between the two fleets. And there was very little action. There was only one encounter that got anywhere near a battle, and that was when one of the Spanish ships was completely isolated and surrounded by a large part of the English fleet. Our vision of the Armada is a fabrication done subsequently. And even after the Armada, which is when English propaganda, anti-Spanish propaganda gets going, most of the most interesting and striking propaganda materials produced, both in terms of text, were translations. Translations from the Dutch and translations from the French. Now, this was absolutely no consolation to Philip II and his subjects, who were utterly devastated by events. They had done so much for God's cause, how could he have failed them? Some Spaniards dared to say that if they failed, it must be because the king's motives for the war had not been sufficiently pure. At the Spanish court, subsequently, however, there was much talk of another campaign in 1589. But lack of finance, combined with Elizabeth's counterattack, effectively deterred all but defensive activity that year. And almost immediately, the situation in France distracted both of them. The assassination of the two Catholic leaders was followed by the assassination of the French king, and these two triggered off a major war in which Philip II believed he was fighting for the faith, for the future of his empire, and for the dynastic rights of his daughter. Now, this was a truly titanic struggle. And not surprisingly, the English war was sidelined, although both Philip and Elizabeth sought to use the French Civil War in order to gain strategic positions that they might use against each other in future. Philip's determination to punish Elizabeth certainly remained, and when the situation permitted, he mounted two other punitive expeditions against England. Both were destroyed by violent storms. Now, this again raised the doubt of what was this war about? If it was a godly war, why was God showing his disapproval of them? But the fiscal burden which these various wars imposed, particularly in Spain, prompted violent reactions and nurtured something akin to a politique position within Philip's empire. In the Castilian Cortes, a member declared that if the heretics wanted to be damned, well, let them be damned. Why should they be having to pay all this money to save the souls of some ungodly people in England? From the Netherlands, Justus Lipsius argued in favor of peace purely on political and commercial grounds, adding, "I have deliberately left out religion and commend it to the theologians." Although, he says, every prudent man knows that the question of religion is the first that we should consider. By 1600, courtly rhetoric allowed negotiators to take matters even further and transmute what had become a grubby and inconclusive little struggle into an elaborate conceit. It was, said one Spanish negotiator, like the assault of the giants against the gods in Valhalla. Significantly, however, the negotiations in the 1590s were inconclusive. Philip II was far more interested in peace with France and the Netherlands than in peace with England. And the English negotiators withdrew in high dudgeon, it has to be said, when they realized that he was using them to better the conditions of peace with these other two. Having gained little and lost little, there was also little incentive to withdraw from the conflict. It may also be that the two old and now hardened monarchs were too stiff-necked for reconciliation. But I think this personalizing of politics does not take us very far. Peace came easily when the situation changed significantly. First, by 1603, the King of Spain was no longer Lord of the Netherlands. Philip II had given this area to his daughter, so England was much less important for Spain. And conversely, Spanish presence in the Netherlands was not as menacing to England. Second, James I stroke one, you can tell I taught in Scotland, that's how you have to say his name. He needed peace in England to consolidate and unite his triple crown. And third, and most important, France was now united under a strong monarch and showed its innate power once again by recovering very quickly. The specter of French universal monarchy had revived, and England and Spain were inescapably drawn together despite their adherence to two increasingly hostile Christian creeds. Their conflict was actually a luxury they could only afford when France was weak. Having closed the door of the Temple of Mars in 1604, Cupid made his comeback. For years, James tried to secure the hand of a Spanish infanta for his son and heir. Hoping that charm would prevail, Prince Charles eventually marched off to Madrid to court her in person. But while he was lavishly entertained, he returned to England empty-handed and promptly declared war on Spain. The joy of the radical Protestants in England was unbounded. They organized bonfires, bell ringing, numerous services of thanksgiving. They also wrote a lot of atrocious commemorative poetry, of which this one verse of a ballad will have to suffice. The Catholic king had a little young thing called Donna Maria, his sister. Our prince went to Spain, her love, but yet, by good luck, he had missed her. The wheel had come full circle. Let me end with a brief conclusion. It seems apt to draw a moral or two from this story. This is, after all, an inaugural lecture. Strikes me that my subject would not have been so distorted if the practice of studying foreign policy in terms of bilateral relations and without due attention to internal and international context had been abandoned rather earlier. Our view of Anglo-Spanish relations has also been adversely influenced by our curiously naive belief in the primacy of ideology, which seems to me to be very much a legacy of Cold War mentality. It's a widely held expectation that whenever ideological divisions are present, be they religious or otherwise, the international system will polarize along ideological lines. It seems apt, therefore, to repeat Geoffrey Elston's advice to me just before I embarked on graduate work. He said something along the lines that when the primary documentation runs counter to your preconceptions and expectations, you should shed these and be prepared to follow the direction that the documents are signaling. He said it rather more elegantly than that, but you get the main point. Now, by doing just this, we can perceive a much more complex and confusing picture of Anglo-Spanish relations than the received wisdom. The two states were certainly not predestined to war, least of all because they had espoused different creeds. While religion played a part in the temporary breach of this long-standing alliance, I hope that I have demonstrated that it was the extraordinary political conjuncture that made both war and peace possible. Although this revisionism diminishes the importance of the Anglo-Spanish struggle, it seems to me that we gain a good deal in the process. It can help us to make some progress towards understanding the complex interrelationship between ideology and power politics, which still bedevils our own age. It proves quite clearly, for example, that the frequent use of confrontational rhetoric in foreign policy
combined with interventionism, creates highly volatile international relations. It is difficult for me not to conclude on a pessimistic note. Shortly after Philip II's death, one of his officials recalled how the king had helped Elizabeth in her youth for political reasons. And he went on to say, I quote, "God preserved her so that she might cause unrest and division in his lands, and to disquiet and upset him and trouble him in his old age, because he gave priority to interests of state and protected a woman who was the enemy of the Catholic Church. Punishment will follow when human interests are given priority over heavenly counsel." Many people criticized this weakness that passed for human prudence, saying, "The dead don't bite." Calling on God and goodness and for the best possible motives, officials such as this urged Philip II to war and assassination, and darkened his final years by blaming him for lack of ideological purity, and thus blaming him for the reverses that beset his empire. If, in the end, pragmatism prevailed, it did so at a huge cost, and its victory owed far more to self-interest than to the power of human reason. Thank you.
Well, I said at the beginning that I thought we were in for a rare treat, and I think Mir has more than fulfilled that expectation. I think we've been treated to a virtuoso display of scholarship, but also proof that it's possible to wear scholarship lightly, and that warmth and wit and humour are not strangers to scholarship. And it's the kind of performance that, for me, quite frankly, was produced one of those very rare occasions when I'm actually proud of my profession. Now, this is an inaugural lecture, which is a very special occasion, and it's an inaugural, it's a beginning, and if this is the kind of thing that the LSE, its teachers and its students, can expect from Professor Rodriguez Salgado, then I hope her tenure of her Chair of International History will be a very long one. As I say, it's an inaugural lecture, and that is a special occasion, and that means it's a rather formal occasion, and we don't have a debate. However, what we do have is a glass of wine. And those of you who want to go on and talk to Mir about what she said, I hope you will all accept our invitation to come up to the senior common room on the fifth floor and join us there for a glass of wine, and join me again in thanking Mir for that really sparkling performance.